Matthew chapter 5, verse 5, in the Beatitudes, we read, Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. Some might translate it, Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. If we go back to Psalm 37:11, which we read this morning, in verse 11, it is the humble will inherit the land and will delight themselves in abundant prosperity. And so when we see the word meek, gentle, or humble, we should try to get a sense of the word. What did it mean both then and now? We see trust in the Lord and do good in that psalm. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in him, and he will do it. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your judgment as the noonday. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. I don't know about all of you, but I'm not a patient waiter sometimes. I don't so much want to talk about it, plan about it, think about it. I just want to get out and do it. But sometimes you have to wait. And so looking at this psalm, we look at the meek. First, they're those who trust in the Lord. And so as a result of this trust, they do good, they delight themselves in the Lord, and they commit their way to the Lord. So they have the faith and the patience to rest in the Lord and wait for him. As I've said before, sometimes waiting gets very hard. Typically, if we're looking for something, whether we want to get something, whether we want to achieve something, whether we're looking for ministry to bear fruit, when do we want it? Now. But we're part of a much greater plan. And that plan is being worked out by God on his timetable and not ours. And so we see from this, the meek man is not necessarily the indolent man who just cannot be bothered to respond to anything. When I sent my son for music lessons, his teacher told me, that's my youngest son, the boy's so laid back he's almost unconscious. It's not a man with no courage who fears to stand up or respond. And so this Greek word, if we look at it, if we look at classical Greek and go back to Aristotle, he considered that word in his work on ethics. And he defined the word as the middle line. Over here is the man that never gets angry about anything, and over here is the man that's angry all the time. And so this word is the middle line. And so the meek man was only angry on the right occasion with the right people. He also got angry at the right time and stayed angry for the correct length of time. Now, I have talked to people that told me, oh, I never do this in the church anymore. Well, why not? Well, 25 years ago, they told me they didn't want me to help with this particular thing, and so I never helped with it again. That person isn't meek. Because they did not stay angry for the appropriate length of time. And I have found it to always be true that in church, conflicts are virtually inevitable. But if you cannot work on the other person and change them, then you got to work on yourself. Sometimes you have to shrug your shoulders and walk away from conflict and say, let it go. So looking at the Greek used at the time of Christ when this was written, the definition of the word here is gentle, enduring all things with an even temper. Tender, free from haughty self-sufficiently, or tender of spirit. You can get angry at anything. I was doing some very fussy work yesterday, and I had to drill a piece with a very small drill, only one I had, and the first time I used it, I pushed a little too hard and broke it off in the material. Guess what? I got angry. But I pulled the broken drill out of the piece and went on. I only stayed angry for the appropriate period of time as I threw the broken drill away and used a bigger one that really wasn't as good. But we can get angry about little things. You know, someone was beeping at me the other day on the road. I said to my wife, there's someone who uses their horn instead of their brakes. You see that? So this word, gentle or meek, was also used to describe domestic animals who were properly behaved. Next door neighbor to my dad had a horse, and that was the most loving horse you ever saw. He would try to get close to you so he could bite you. That horse was not meek. So domestic animals who were behaved so you could work with them, domesticated to be both peaceful and reliable. By extension, it's also used of people who know how to behave well-mannered in a polite fashion. Here in English, gentle is used in the same sense of the word gentleman. And gentleman is considered that people could be at ease with them, whether they're of very low station in life or of high station. And so you do not grovel before the high station, nor do you condescend to the low station, but you treat them as you would like to be treated. Now, our human tendency is to become angry when we're bothered. So, as simple a thing as someone driving in front of us at a rate of speed 20 miles below the speed limit can get us what? Angry. It happens. And so many things in daily life can anger. Some people will get angry. Some people will get enraged. You see road rage incidents where someone shoots another guy, you know, defending his right of way, apparently. And by this, we see that meekness is not a common trait. It's not widespread. From the work of Aristotle, we can see the word meek defined as our behavior, specifically in the treatment of our fellow men. From the Psalm, we see it defined in respect to our attitude toward God. Wait for God. Delight yourself in God. commit your way to God, rest in God, wait patiently. And so we could see this beatitude as a quote from this particular psalm, which it might have been, but also as a summary of the entire ministry of Christ. He was meek, he was lowly, and we see him in obedience to the Father, teaching all things that he received from the Father, and also suffering, even to the death on the cross, all in obedience. And so if you would like the poster child for being meek, there it is. Now, it's not that he never got annoyed when they had the temple courts and were taking advantage of people, made it kind of into a racket like a carnival or Disneyland or whatever. He was angry. He said, this is supposed to be a house of prayer, not a den of thieves. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And this verse has got to be seen in the context of what's already been said. We must never lift a verse out of context and try to make it go where the whole passage is not going. And so we have the person because we see, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And so we have the person who knows that they're spiritually poor as compared to the righteousness of God. They mourn for the sin which separates them from fellowship with God. Now, the word meek can also be translated as gentle. And if we become aware of the poverty of spirit, being spiritually poor, and if we mourn for sin, we cannot be arrogant toward God. We must be meek. We have not advised him first. He has not borrowed from us. In fact, we have nothing to give him. He gives to us. Not being arrogant toward God also leads us to refrain from being arrogant toward our fellow man. If we don't have our own righteousness, but have been given righteousness through Christ, are we then any better than any other man? For what do we have that we were not given? The answer is no, we're not better than other men. For we have a similar nature. We have a similar background. But we have enjoyed the free gift of salvation by faith, through grace. Our attitude toward our fellow men, then, is that we wish them to enjoy the same salvation. For the gift of God is not diminished, no matter how much it's shared. In fact, the more you give away, the more you have. Like Paul said to Agrippa, we would have them be as we are. He said, except for these chains, I wish you were just like me. And so, as we have said before, this particular message is at variance with human nature. For in this society we have, we see those who are aggressive or pushy crowding their way to the head of the line and trampling over those who are less aggressive. And we see that this often works. And in my public life, I ran across people that I used to call yellers. They'd start yelling when they didn't get their own way. And many times, just to shut them up, someone would give them their own way. People tend to repeat patterns of successful behavior and then get frustrated if that particular behavior doesn't work in that particular circumstance. So then they try to double down. Now, it's important to remember that the audience to this sermon was mostly, if not exclusively, Jewish. And so if we look at Israel, at the time this message was given, they wanted a Messiah. But they wanted the Messiah from their mind, the Messiah of their imagination. Guess what? If you make up a Jesus in the image that you like, that's no different than the idol of Molech or any other idol, or Baal. Because you take Jesus as you find him, not as you imagine him. And so, Israel at the time wanted a Messiah to sit on the throne of David and chase off Rome. That's what they were looking for, a literal kingdom, not a spiritual kingdom. Now, you might say we don't have this today, but you see politicians on one side of the spectrum saying, we're going to spend all this money and we're going to take care of the poor and we're going to build a very good society, and the government is going to do everything. And they faithfully believe that as Israel wanted a king on the throne, that that'll do it. We see people on the other side of the political spectrum that want to go in a different direction, and they want more of a moral code enforced by the government. They're going to say, we're going to pass a law against this, we're going to pass a law against this, we're going to pass a law against this, and we're going to make people be good. And a great experiment in that was prohibition back in the 20s. Didn't work out so well. And so we still have this today, only in different form. I can confidently tell you there is no salvation in left-wing politics or right-wing politics. It's not there. Salvation is found in faith in Christ, as set forth in the Word. And so if we go back to the very first king, Israel wanted someone to go and fight their battles. We want to be like everybody else. And Samuel was very distraught. And of course, Samuel was partially at fault because his sons were not like him. You know, they like to get a little money on the side to help them decide the case in favor of the person that slipped them the money. But God said the people had not rejected Samuel from leading them, but rather rejected God because they lacked the faith to believe God could raise up a faithful judge. At the time of Christ, Israel was in the same place. The rejection of Jesus as the Christ was really a mirror image of what the nation did when they rejected Samuel and wanted a king. Not spiritual, secular, not from God, from man. Freedom from Rome, not freedom from sin. A king, rather than following God. And inclusion in this kingdom based on descent from Abraham, rather than the condition of the heart. They didn't want to hear about being born again. They didn't want to hear what is flesh, what is spirit. They wanted the son of David to come and sit on the throne. Now, David went to war and enlarged the borders of Israel, but there came a time when he wanted to build a temple. And he was told, you've shed a lot of blood on the face of the earth, and you aren't going to build a temple. I'll give your son peace, and he'll build it. But Israel wanted a Messiah in the mold of David. That's what they were looking for. And Jesus is teaching that his methods and his kingdom is not like that. That's not who I am. The concept of acknowledging poverty of spirit and mourning for sin concern our relationship with God. This is the attitude we should have toward him. Not arrogant at all. We have nothing to be arrogant about. But the verse speaking of being meek or gentle concerns our treatment of our fellow man and our attitude toward God. And in this verse, we see the sermon beginning to shift a little bit and treating how we interact with our fellow man. So, where are our needs? Where are our interests? Abraham had Lot with him, and when the herds became too much and there began to be conflict because of the grazing capacity of the range could only sustain so much and there was only so many wells of water, the herdsmen began to argue, and Abraham said to Lot, "Now, Lot, I don't want trouble. We're kinsmen. There shouldn't be trouble between us. Let's separate. And guess what? You take first choice. Whatever you want, you take. Whatever's left, I'll take." Now, he was the elder man. And deep ancient tradition would have given him first choice. But he didn't demand his right. He said, "Lot, pick what you want. If you go left, I'll go right. If you go right, I'll go left." When he came back from the war, when he chased and when Lot was taken, the king of Sodom there said, "Give me back the people. I got to have someone to be king over. But keep the spoil. Keep the spoil for yourself. To the victor belongs the spoil." Words of Andrew Jackson, actually, but still it's an ancient tradition. And what did Abraham say? "I will not take anything, not even a shoelace, lest you say you have made Abraham rich. The men who came with me, let them take their share, but aside from that, take the goods back." See how careful he was. Number one, he didn't take anything for himself. But number two, he didn't give away to share the guys that went with him. In other words, he wasn't generous with somebody else's money or stuff. That's a lesson that today's politicians have never learned. They can be incredibly generous with someone else's money and then pat themselves on the back for doing it. Abraham gave what was his. He had taken the risk. By all rules of war and all ancient custom, all the spoil belonged to him. He said, "No, you can have it. I have enough. I don't need it." Who today would get a windfall of some kind or another and give it away? A boy came to the Christian school one time and was passing out $20 bills to his fellows. And the teacher got wind of it and said, "Hey, what's going on?" And he'd run across a bag of money, a very large sum. And so the teacher took the money, gathered up the $20 bills, and they called the local police, and they said, this is found money. The police took it into custody. A year later, the police called him up, told the school, come and get this money. No one ever claimed it. And so there was a discussion at the school board level, what are we going to do with this money? But unfortunately, there was a troublemaker on the board. And that man said, wait a minute, that's not your money. You didn't find it. You confiscated it from the kid that found it. Now call his mother and see if the family wants it, because it's not yours. Oddly enough, the family wanted the money, and so that was the end of that particular discussion. But you can see that when there's a windfall in sight, sometimes the ethical lines get blurred. Chapter 25 of 1 Samuel, David is fleeing from Saul, but he's been promised the throne of Israel. And Nabal is the local well-off guy. He's the country squire that's got land and sheep and vineyards and so forth. And you have to remember now, gifts were ingrained in that culture. And it's true to this day. Some people call it corruption. Some people call it gifts. In the Middle East, they call it bakshish. It's all the same thing. And so David and his men had been in the vicinity of the herdsmen for an extended period of time, up in the hills. They're hiding out from Saul. They were armed, and they could have taken animals from the herd and eaten them. They could have demanded so much milk every day, but they didn't. They protected the herdsmen from any local robbers, and the herdsmen actually said they were like a wall to us both day and night. So when the sheep were sheared and the wool could be sold, that's, you know, like payday, which in agriculture sometimes comes only once a year. And so David thought, that's an appropriate time to ask for a gift. And the gift is an acknowledgement in the Middle East of the relative positions, the position of the person getting the gift and the person offering the gift. Even a small gift could be seen as sufficient. But what did Nabal do? I'm not giving you anything. Who is this guy anyway? And so he gives no gifts. To this he adds insulting words. So David and his band said, well, let's go down there. We're going to kill every man in that household. We'll show them some respect. But it didn't take place. It didn't happen. But the victory was not by sword and not by spear, but by the gentle deeds, the meek deeds, the humble deeds of Abigail, the wife of Nabal. By meeting David with food and drink, with an apology, she diffused the whole thing. She turned aside the wrath. There was not enough fighting men in Nabal's household to withstand the 600 men that were following David. And so, with a logical mind, the only two options were to make a stand and fight the best you can or run away. And who could have ever predicted that a woman with no sword, no spear, no military expertise, by some provisions and gracious words, could turn the whole thing around? But she did. And so, in this case, being meek or gentle was rewarded by peace, and the vengeance was turned aside. Much later, in chapter 16 of 2 Samuel, David was fleeing from his son Absalom, and as he goes, there's a man that's a relative of Saul going along the hillside, throwing stones at him and throwing dirt at him and cursing him. And he had some military guys with him, tough guys. And one of them said, "Hey, I'm not putting up with this anymore. Let me go kill that guy." David said, "No, let him curse. Perhaps the Lord has told him to curse." And so the man was spared. And when David came back after the defeat of Absalom, he came back and his kingdom was restored. This man came to beg pardon. David spared him. "All right, you can keep your life." This verse then has a horizontal and a vertical component. Blessed are the meek, or blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. Our attitude toward God, our attitude toward our fellow man. One of the things I've said different times over my career, and you've probably heard it before, the true measure of a man is what he does when he can do as he wishes. I've said this to many people, and sometimes when some kind of plan of action was being considered. If you have the power and authority and the freedom to take action, the action you take is a direct reflection of who you are. Are you harsh and unpleasant in the action you take? That's who you are. That's what you would always do if you had the power to do it. Are you reasonable? Are you fair? Are you gentle in the action you take? That's who you are. And that's what you would do all the time if you had the authority to do it. Any situation that calls for action, there's different options, different routes to travel, different ways to go. Very seldom is there a problem or an issue that can only be solved in one way. Quite often, the option you pick is going to say more about you than it's going to say about the problem you address. What would you have liked to do all along? Now that the moment permits, you do it. Now, you may say, "I don't have the power of life and death like those Oriental kings of old." That's true. But you have something. Those of us who raised children had authority over the children while they were small. In the workplace, there are decisions that need to be made, and if you're in some kind of position of authority, you can be reasonable or you can be arbitrary. In our families, we can mend fences and try to patch things up, or we can say, "I don't want anything to do with you." But all these decisions we make speak volumes about us. In the local church, there's always going to be personalities at work, kind of rubbing against one another. Whether they abrade each other or polish each other, depends on the intent of the persons in question. If we look at 1 Timothy and the qualifications for an overseer, we find a person should be temperate, prudent, and respectable. He should not be pugnacious, as in always ready or looking for a fight. Uncontentious, as in trying to conciliate rather than battle. These are all things really contained in this verse. It's something of a roadmap for the relationship with God, for the relationship with man. You know the old poem, "To live above with saints in love, oh, that would be glory. But to live below with saints we know, well, that's another story." But this is the gold standard. Blessed are the meek, blessed are the gentle, blessed are the humble. And so we need to try to remember that in our daily dealings, and remember that the path you take and the decision you make on any given problem is most likely going to say more about you than it's going to say about the problem. Our closing hymn